The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
I am extraordinarily excited to speak to my next guest because she has written a genuinely magnificent book on one of the most important subjects to me in the world, C.S. Lewis. Let me say, first of all, her name is Christiana Hale. She hails, spelled differently, from Idaho. She is in Idaho right now. Just so you understand, while she was writing this book, she also teaches Latin and English to junior high school students. Can try to take that in, ladies and gentlemen. At a classical a Christian school, I am just thrilled to meet her and to talk to her about her brand new book. It's called Deeper Heaven, A Reader's Guide to C.S. Lewis's Ransom Trilogy. Christiana Hale, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, listen, we tried to get you in the studio and our schedule was all screwed up. But I just want to say, when I read this book, I was just so thrilled because I love C.S. Lewis so much. And the Ransom Trilogy, the Space Trilogy, whatever it's called, many, many people are not familiar with it. And that, of course, needs to change. And books like yours will help to change. I'm already are helping to it is helping to change that. Your book is helping to change that. So I before we get into the book, Deeper Heaven, I just have to ask you about yourself. How does a very young woman like yourself come to write a magnificent volume on C.S. Lewis's Ransom Trilogy? How did this happen? Where did you grow up? How did you happen? What's going on?
Yeah, sometimes I ask myself how it happened because it still surprises me at times that this is where life has taken me. But I grew up on C.S. Lewis, primarily the Chronicles of Narnia, as many of us did. So a very young age, I was introduced to Narnia and just fell in love with those books. And it wasn't till I was probably in high school that I realized there's a lot more to C.S. Lewis than just a children's fiction author. In fact, that was a very small part of his life and his calling and what he did. So I remember reading or starting to read the Ransom Trilogy at a young age, and I actually, quite frankly, didn't like it. I didn't get into it really. I couldn't understand it. But then I attended New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho, and as a freshman rhetoric class, we had to read the Ransom Trilogy. And at that point, with a teacher who delved deeper into especially the medieval cosmology side of things, which I think we'll probably talk about later, that just captured my imagination. I really, really loved that side of it, and realized that there was a lot more going on in those books than
there's
I
so much going
thought.
On that. That's what makes Lewis the more astonishing. I mean, when you You can be I recently spoke to James Como on this program about he has a new book about Paralandra. He's written many C.S. Lewis books over the decades, and his new book is about Paralandra, which is the middle book of this Ransom Trilogy. And it was just such a joy to talk to him about that and to introduce audiences to that book. But you deal with all three books. And let's first of all start out with the idea that it's called the Ransom Trilogy. A lot of people call it the Space Trilogy, which is a little weird. But it is what I say it's kind of like the Narnia books for adults. In other words, now don't get me wrong. I read the Narnia books for the first time when I was just a little younger than you. I mean, I think I was 30 when I first read the Narnia books, and I was blown away because, like a lot of great literature that we call it kids literature, it's actually not. It's simply a genre that can be read to kids, but it's perfectly appropriate, more than appropriate for adults. There's so much there that kids will never get. You have to grow up to kind of understand the depths of it. But it's like Lewis, you know, he wrote these three books before the Narnia books, and I often describe them as, you know, Narnia, the Narnia world for adults. But there's a darkness to them. I mean, they really just are magnificent. So when did you think it was worth writing an entire book of your own? And obviously, I have a copy here. It's called Deeper Heaven, about the Ransom Trilogy. When did that idea occur to you? Because it's a very big idea.
Mm-hmm. So the first stage of it really was in my undergraduate studies. I decided to tackle the Ransom Trilogy for my undergraduate thesis. And that was much narrower focus. It was more specific and argumentative, I would say. I had a specific thesis statement that I was looking at. I was looking at primarily the medieval cosmology that Lewis loved and that he implements in the trilogy. And it was much narrower topic, but so it started out writing that thesis. And as I was writing it, for one thing, once you dive in, you start noticing more and more. So I was finding elements that I couldn't work into that paper, but was stowing away for perhaps a later project. But the bigger thing that happened throughout that project was as I talked to people about it, specifically people from back home or from family, friends, or a lot of homeschooling moms or students. And I had so many people just saying, why are you writing about the Ransom Trilogy? It's so weird. That was the recurring theme, was it's so weird. And I don't understand it. And what's the point? What's going on there? And I found myself trying more and more to point them in certain directions. So like, where is there a good, solid guide or a book that I can just say, here, read this. This will explain why I think it's such an amazing book and give you a good foundation. And there's many good books on the trilogy out there, but there wasn't quite the thing I was looking for, which was a more comprehensive guide through the fundamental themes and that paid a special attention to the medieval aspect. And so when it came time to my graduate studies, I thought to myself, well, if there's not something out there that I want to point people to, I might as well, since I've done all this research, just write it, write it myself.
I'm glad I asked you that question, because in a funny way, well, first of all, it reminds me of something that I'd forgotten, that in fact, there is no such book. You have written the book. It's called Deeper Heaven, A Reader's Guide to C.S. Lewis's Ransom Trilogy. And I often think that that's why books get written. It happened to me with my Bonhoeffer book. I kept thinking, there's no Bonhoeffer book that I would consider definitive that I could say to somebody, oh, you got to read that. They all were somehow missing it, or they were focused on something so narrow or what. And I thought, what a crime. Like, there should be a book that you can just say, just read this and you'll get it. And it didn't exist. And that's what launched me into writing my Bonhoeffer book. And I really think that with Lewis's Ransom Trilogy, you're quite right that there is not. I mean, often I'll tell people to read the books, but you want to kind of draw them in so that they're understanding what you bring out in the books. And now, but again, because you're so young, I realize, look, when I first read Lewis, it was before I got to know Michael Ward, who wrote his book Planet Narnia and that kind of stuff, and talked about medieval cosmology. So I wasn't even tapped in to the medieval cosmology. Talk a little bit about the medieval cosmology in the last couple of minutes so people can get a sense, because that sounds like a scary concept. What do you mean by medieval cosmology?
Yes. So cosmology is just a very, very fancy word, just meaning arrangement, right? So we get the word cosmos from the Greek, means to arrange or order something. So we actually do get the word cosmetology from that, but it's not the same thing. But you're putting things in a certain order. So when we say medieval cosmology, we're just talking about how medieval man saw the arrangement of the universe, of the cosmos, which was different from, we had the Copernican Revolution, where and most people are familiar with that sort of shift from a Earth-centric, geocentric arrangement to a solar system having the sun at the center. But beyond just the arrangement in the medieval conception of the cosmos, there were actual imaginative effects. They had a very peculiar view of more than just, oh, we're just switching the order around, but that that order actually has an effect on the way you look at humanity and the man's place in the cosmos. So it has anthropological effects as well, right? That there's all sorts of, and philosophical and theological effects. So when we say medieval cosmology, you could simply say, well, it's just the arrangement of the cosmos, but it actually has downstream effects on the way they saw the entire world.
So Christiana, C.S. Lewis wrote so much. Some people know him from the Screwtape Letters. Many people know the Narnia Chronicles and blah, 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 blah. Very few people know that he wrote an absolutely spectacular trilogy of novels for adults, often called the Ransom Trilogy. They are literally magnificent, and they're full of so much stuff, so much genius, so many levels. But one level which is vital and which you write about in your book, which you clarify, is this thing called the medieval cosmology. So let's just break it down for the audience. The ancients believed, and the medieval world believed, that the earth is at the center. Now, we now know that's not true, but it kind of doesn't matter. They believe the earth is at the center, and then they could see with the naked eye, before telescopes, they could see the sun, the moon, and Mercury, Mars, Saturn, Venus, and Jupiter. That's it, right? So those were the medieval planets. And when you talk about medieval cosmology, first, that's what you're talking about, correct?
Yes, yes, correct. So the seven planets of their cosmology. But beyond that, they saw the planets as having very distinct personalities too, which is something that's very foreign to us. We just look up and we see them and they're pretty in the night sky and they're bright.
So give us an example of what we mean
yes,
by that.
So for example, Jupiter, I would argue they would see as one of the most important planets, and so in the system. So he is, and I say he because it's very connected to the Roman god Jupiter, after whom it's named. But they would see him as the king of the planets. So as Jupiter is the king of the Roman gods, and so connected with kingliness and all of the qualities that are associated with what we think of a king being like. You can see, also they could see with the naked, well, not quite with the naked eye, but as rudimentary telescopes were developed, they could see the spot in Jupiter's side. So he's the wounded king, which then draws connections to Christ, obviously, on the cross. His side was pierced. And so there comes into all of these then theological connotations as well. And so not that they would see the planets as being distinct from the planetary being. So there's some conflicting accounts. Lewis uses the one where they think of the planet itself, physical planet, as being almost like a mode of transportation for an angelic being that is also the planet, in a sense,
actually,
the planetary figure.
There's so much to it. I guess the maybe the simplest place to start is when, and your book touches on this, but it's not about this, but the idea that Michael Ward writes about, that the seven Narnia Chronicles, that every one of them corresponds to one of these medieval planets. So obviously the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe corresponds to Jupiter because it's about,
yes,
a king. And then you get this idea of why is Father Christmas in there? Well, he's this Jupiter, jovial, kingly, happy character. Because when we use phrases like we say somebody's jovial, that's what it means. Prince Caspian has this Mars, martial, warring thing. Like there are all these personalities. I guess Venus is the perfect example. Talk about, you know, like Venus and Mars, for example, so people can get some idea, or about the sun. because I want people to grasp this idea. When you talk about the personalities of these planets, it's almost like a poetic conceit, right?
Yes, it's almost like creating an entire world around a single theme, right? Around a certain note that you're trying to hit. And these planetary personalities kind of involve all of this imagery, poetry, atmosphere. They're kind of all wrapped up together, and it's hard to tease them out, which is why I think Dr. Michael Ward's thesis is so brilliant, and the way that he teases that out from the Chronicles of Narnia. The more you read them, the more you see it, and the more it makes sense and kind of comes into alignment. So, for example, I personally love The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. That's one of my favorites, and it's the solar book, or the book associated with the sun. And I mean, that one you see very clearly just in the title, right? You have the Dawn Treader. There's the sun in the title, and they're heading east. They're heading towards the sun throughout the entire book. But then as you continue to dive even deeper, you have little details like the sun's metal is gold, and they come to that one island where the water turns things to gold, and gold is a theme. You have dragons. Apollo, the sun god in Greek mythology, is associated with dragon slaying. One of his names is Apollo Sauroctonos, which means killer of the dragon. And so there's the whole story with him and the python, which some argue is a dragon. So there's dragons all over the place, a dragon on the prow of the boat, the dragon, of course, that Eustace turns into, the dragon they find on the island, the sea dragon, the sea monster. There's dragons all over the place as well, which you might think, how does that connect to the sun? But as you dig more deeply into this personality, you can see how it connects.
And I think the key to say is, so that people don't get scared away, it doesn't matter if you get all this stuff. That's the beauty of it, is that even if you don't get any of this stuff and you just read these books, what they are, they're magnificent. Let's leave aside the medieval cosmology for a moment, just to familiarize the audience with the plot of these three books. The first book is Out of the Silent Planet. The second book is Perelandra. And the third book is That Hideous Strength. That's the Ransom Trilogy. But talk about the general plot. What is this about? Why is it called the Ransom Trilogy?
Yes. I think the first book, Lewis intended, I think, at the beginning to actually only write a single book. This happened frequently for him, where he would kind of get sidetracked and it would turn into something bigger than he maybe initially intended it to. And I would argue the first book is almost a kind of a there and back again, almost like the Hobbit story, right? We have our main character who inadvertently stumbles upon these men who are trying to abduct a boy to take him to Mars, to sacrifice him to the Martians. So they think the natives require a sacrifice, and so they're trying to abduct this boy. He intervenes. He ends up getting kidnapped in the boy's place, and so he ends up taken to Mars in their spaceship, and basically the rest of the book is him trying to find his way and figure out how to get back.
Okay, this is the first book called Out of the Silent Planet.
First book, Out of the Silent Planet.
And Ransom, yes. Who's appropriately named because he's a type of Christ, and also he goes in the place of the boy who these evil characters are trying to kidnap to take to Mars as a sacrifice or whatever. So that's the first book, and that was written, what, 39? When was that written?
I believe so. I am really, really bad at memorizing dates. So I believe it was around end of the 30s. So yes, so 39 sounds right. Might have been 40, right around there.
And in a funny way, I mean, this is at the beginning of science fiction. I mean, Lewis, you know, there was some science fiction, H.G. Wells or whatever, but Lewis is writing. It's fantasy. It's a kind of science fiction. But it's more than that. It's very literary. And so you do think that the first book, Out of the Silent Planet is Earth, I guess?
Yes. Yes, it is.
That you think that he just meant to just write that book about this guy, Ransom, going to Mars and then coming back?
I do. And I think that for two main reasons. First, so the book came about as kind of a game or a challenge between him and Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings. They were talking about stories and kind of bemoaning the lack of stories of the kind that they both liked. Like, there's not enough good stories out there that we like, so let's write some. And so the challenge was Tolkien was going to write a time traveling story, and Lewis was going to write a space traveling story. Tolkien actually started a time traveling story called The Lost Road, and it was meant to connect his Middle Earth with the contemporary time period, but he never finished it. Somewhat typical Tolkien fashion. He's very much a perfectionist, wanted everything to be perfect, and so it fell off. But Lewis, in typical Lewis fashion, didn't write just one book, but he turned it into a trilogy. But I do think the one book was kind of the answer to that challenge. And the way he had, second reason is the way he ends that book, he kind of ends it with this manifesto on why he thinks this is important, and he hopes that this will inspire more exploration of this sort of topic and how he hopes that his readers come away with this sense of not so much space, but returning to a conception of the heavens instead. And so the way he ends that book, it very much feels like he's kind of done, right? He even makes a comment about time travel, which is kind of tongue-in-cheek, poking Tolkien, like, okay, now it's your turn, right? Handing the baton to him. So it very much feels kind of like he was going to only leave it there, but we're very glad he didn't. And he wrote two more books and finished out that trilogy. But I do think it was kind of a second plan. It didn't start out as a trilogy.
It's just amazing. And if anybody just wants to see the genius of Lewis, I mean, what he does in these books is just genius. You can hardly believe that he did anything else with his life because these books are so amazing. But the first book, I mean, to sum it up, it's a trip to Mars. And of course, because this is the late 30s, it's completely, you know, fantastical view of Mars. And the second book is a trip to Venus. And the third book is That Hideous Strength. But talk about what he finds on Mars, because this points to the literary genius of Lewis to create a world like a complete, I mean, it's a lot like what Tolkien does in a way, just create another world so convincingly. But so talk briefly about what he finds, what this Ransom character finds when he gets to Mars.
Yes. So the fascinating thing about what he finds on Mars is he encounters three species, you could say, of creature on Mars. They are sentient beings that are not human. And the fascinating thing that he does there is that it's actually an unfallen planet that is yet affected by the fall of man. So there's this kind of odd juxtaposition of Ransom, a fallen human being, interacting with these sentient, intelligent beings that are not human and are unfallen and have no real conception of sin nature. And so it really leads to a series of fascinating conversations, which is something that I don't think you could have in the same way if it was set on Earth, for example, or if Lewis was having, or Ransom, sorry, was having these conversations with another man. By putting it on another planet, by introducing these creatures, he has all these very fascinating intellectual and philosophical, theological questions that come about that don't bore the reader, even though there can be pages of just conversation. Same thing in Paralandra, even more so, I would say. And yet it's just fascinating because it's because of the backdrop and the setting and the nature of his conversation partner, that they are having these conversations that we would never have. And yet Lewis geniusly unravels certain questions that we do have and we do struggle with. And yet he can address them in a very unique way because Ransom is talking to what we might call an alien, right? It's a foreign species, foreign conversational partner. And so that's one of the brilliant things I think that he does in both
That's what reveals like the level of his genius. That it's a freaky mm-hmm. level of genius to be able to pull this off. Okay, so in the first book, Out of the Silent Planet, this Ransom figure goes to Mars, ostensibly Mars. But what's so interesting is he discovers, you know, they're not our version of Martians. When we think of Martians, our fictitious version of Martians, we think of a certain thing. In a way, that world hadn't been established yet, that fictional world that we all kind of live in and where we think Martians look like this or whatever. So what are these three creatures, these types of creatures that he encounters on his version of Mars?
Yeah, so there's the three types. There's the Hrasa, and again, I'm going to attempt to pronounce these correctly.
Everyone is impossible. You know, every pronunciation. Yeah. So the first one is what? Say it again.
Hrasa.
H-R-O-S-S-A.
H-R-O-S-S, yes.
Hrasa. So yeah, and they're like gigantic gerbils or something.
Yes, or beaver type. I can't imagine them as beaver type, some sort of mammal type of creature.
Okay, keep going.
And then we have the Sorns.
The creepy Sorns.
Easiest to pronounce.
Sorns really freaked me out when I first read about them.
Yeah, they did. They're kind of bird-like, and they're huge. They're giant, gigantic, and they're kind of almost winged and bird-like.
But in the beginning, they're menacing. You don't know. I mean, that's what's so creepy about these books is that you could see Lewis's he has the ability to write about evil and to scare you. So these are not good books for like little kids or anything. But
yeah, Ransom sees one and runs from it. Yeah, Sorn. He actually sees one and that's one of the things that sets him running away because he sees it and he's just terrified by it. But then he encounters the Hrasa, which are a lot less intimidating at first. And he gets to know them. He actually lives with them for a while. So then by the time he actually meets a Sorn again and has interaction with it, he's still intimidated and terrified in a way. But he understands it. He at least understands what he's seeing and is able to interact with and have conversations with.
Now I dare you to try to pronounce the third kind of creature on Mars. Let's see.
I think it's Fiffeltriggy.
Gesundheit. Say it again.
Yeah. Fiffeltriggy.
Fiffeltriggy. Fiffeltriggy.
Yeah, that's how I say it.
I think you're just playing with my head. Christiana, let's get serious. No, I've actually, when I read that word, I was like, there's literally no way to pronounce this. But you think it's what again?
So I think it's Fiffeltriggy. Fiffeltriggy. So there's a P. The problem is there's a PF. He starts out with a PF, but the P has got to be silent. There's no way.
Fiffeltriggy.
It's not silent, I think.
Fiffeltriggy. I got a bad case of Fiffeltriggy. I can't come. Okay, so so the three creatures are the Sorns, the Hrasa, and the Fiffeltriggy. And I don't remember what do the Fiffeltriggy look like.
So they're almost he mentions dwarves, but then he also I think mentions frogs. So
right.
In describing them. So they're very small, they're short, squat, and close to the ground. They are the ones that work primarily with their hands, so they create things. They're kind of like the miners, the makers. And when Ransom in the book encounters one, he's actually carving a statue of Ransom.
Oh, the Fiffeltriggy is carving a statue of Ransom.
And at first he doesn't recognize it as a statue of himself because it looks so weird to him. It looks because he's seeing it through the Fiffeltrig's eyes, right? He's seeing, oh, this is what I look like to them. And it's so foreign to him, he doesn't actually realize it's him at first. And then he's also carving a map of the cosmos, which is really fascinating because that's where we see that Lewis in the trilogy is not using the medieval order of the planets. He's actually using our solar system in terms of the arrangement.
Holy cow.
Of the planets.
Now, so the first book is a trip to Mars. The second book is a trip to Venus. The third book is called That Hideous Strength, which is a really bizarre book that kind of almost stands on its own. But let's just kind of keep going with the plot, the overview of these three books. So the first book, this guy Ransom, he doesn't know what he's getting into, right? Like he's a guy that's just kind of on a walking tour and he kind of stumbles on this dark situation with these people, these nefarious scientists wanting to kidnap this boy and take him to Mars to sacrifice him. And so he sort of intervenes. And so he inadvertently finds himself going to Mars.
Yes, that is right. In the first book. So, and then if we're moving on to the second book, in the second book, it's less accidental. It's more on purpose. And what's fascinating to me is that the whole reason the second book happens, though, is because of the first book. And this is Lewis's genius, is that this first book was a total accident. Ransom just stumbled into this situation. But because of this kidnapping, because he was taken to Mars, the important thing that happens is that Ransom was a philologist, meaning he studied languages. And being taken to Mars, he was fascinated by the fact that these creatures are speaking a different language. It's a language that's entirely unknown on Earth. It's called Old Solar. And he learns
Old
this language, of course.
Solar.
Old Solar.
I mean, this
solar.
Stuff is so yes. – we can talk for days about every single one of these weird concepts. So we want to – I want to remind my readers, in case they don't know, and to tell them, imagine a world where C.S. Lewis is friends with J.R.R. Tolkien. They're hanging out. They're going to the Bird and the Baby pub, and they're drinking their ale and talking and sharing stories. So there's this amazing level of – literary community and one-upsmanship, and I'm going to write this book and you write that book. It's hard to believe that that ever existed. And Tolkien and Lewis are both totally into philology, into the study of languages and whatever. I mean, talk a little bit, since you know about this, about Tolkien inventing for his books, like he invents a language. I mean, I don't know how far he got, but he did.
Yes. Well, this is a language that, I mean, you can, if you wanted to, take a course in Elvish.
I don't want to.
At various places.
I don't want to. you can't make
if
me.
If you wanted to.
No, I don't want to.
But the point is, the language is that well-developed, at least in Tolkien's side, to where you can actually learn how to speak it, which if you know other languages at all, it's very difficult. There's a lot that goes into.
How nerdy are you? That's the question. Do you speak Elvish? Do you have an Elvish tattoo?
No,
I don't mean you. No. I just mean I'm speaking to my audience. Like, how nerdy do you want to be?
Yeah.
So, but I'm bringing this up because they both were interested in this stuff, right?
Yeah.
So you have Lewis is totally into this stuff. Tolkien is into this stuff. But you're saying that, I forgot this, that Ransom, the character, is a philologist, totally into language. And so he goes to Mars and he encounters a foreign language.
Yes. And that's actually one of the things that pulls him out of his terror, because it's a very shocking experience first when he realizes that he's in a spaceship, because he actually gets, he's unconscious when they take him onto the spaceship. So then
he's
comes out of it. He wakes up. Yes, he's on the spaceship. And when he realizes where he is, that's a terrifying experience. And then when they get to Mars, he's scared and he runs away. And so, but part of the thing that brings him out of that is when he realizes that when he encounters the first non-human being on Mars, it's one of the Hrasa, he encounters them and he realizes it's talking, it's communicating, it's speaking a language. And that totally, he has this moment where he starts imagining going back to Earth and writing a book on Mars, its language and its uses or whatever. And he totally nerds out basically about the fact that this is a language that no one has ever heard or learned or diagnosed or pulled apart or understood. And so that's one thing that kind of snaps him out of his terror and leads him to start interacting with the Hrasa so that he can actually just learn their language. And that's the key point that leads to Paralandras. The reason that he's taken to Venus in the second book, he's actually taken there and asked to go there by the Eldila, which are angelic beings, and the Oriarsa, which are the greater angelic beings. He's sent there for a purpose, primarily not because he's this amazing person, but because he knows the language. He's basically just an interpreter.
Oh, wait a minute. So you're saying that, because I forgot this, and even though I read your book, I forgot. So when he goes to Mars, because he's a philologist, he has the ability, in a sense, to learn their language, which is Old Solar, and of course refers to the solar system. And so he learns this. So he's then sent on a mission to Paralandra because he speaks Old Solar.
Yes, exactly.
So the second book is the trip to Venus or Paralandra, and I'm trying to remember what happens roughly in the first book. What's the plot of the first book, other than that he goes there and encounters these strange beings on Mars? I don't remember the ending.
So the characters that take him, Weston and Divine, are the two men that end up that kidnap him, and they want to. Well, they kind of have different.
They're both bad people,
right? They're both bad. They both want different things, but they are neither one of them good. And so it ends, though, with their purposes being thwarted and the Oyarsa of Mars, which is like the angelic being of the planet, sends them back. So he sends them back to Earth. But the key thing that happened, and this maybe goes a little bit back to the medieval cosmology, is that the medievals believed that there's a barrier between the moon and the rest of this medieval cosmology, the cosmos. So the moon is basically everything under the moon has been affected by sin and the fall, and everything above the moon, the translunar realm, is unfallen. And there's a barrier there that's why it's called out of the silent planet, is that the Earth is the silent planet. It's silent. Great deeper heaven can't hear what's going on down there because there's this barrier that's been put up. But when Weston and Divine go to Mars, they break that barrier, which means that there can be back and forth, basically, between Earth and the rest.
Which is bad. In other words,
can be bad, and it ends up being good in the last book, right? There's kind of
well, it can
ways.
Be redeemed, but the point is that they have, in a sense, you know, it's kind of like bringing slavery to the states in the West. It's like you're bringing this evil into a place where it didn't exist before, which is
exactly.
What I see. This is what I'm saying. I'm forgetting all this stuff. But and part of the genius for me is how Lewis can really portray evil. I mean, these are dark, evil characters. And he also shows the evil of science, the potential evil of science, that science is not all good, which was part of the myth of that era, you know, the 30s or whatever. And then he's saying, oh, no, it can be used for evil. So they are sent back, I just don't remember how it ends. So I don't know if you.
Yeah, he wraps it up very quickly. So there's this whole conversation between the Oyarsa of Malakandra and Ransom, who's again acting kind of as an interpreter, because the two evil men know bits and pieces of phrases, but they can't really speak the language. So so Ransom is kind of in between, translating basically back and forth. And the Oyarsa just says, well, we have to send you back, right? You have to go back, and we don't know if you'll make it or not, but you have to leave. You can't stay here. That's not allowed. So they're sent back in the spaceship. They do make it back to Earth, and it kind of ends very abruptly. Ransom wakes up, and it's raining, and it's the great scene because he's so glad that it's raining, and he goes and has a pint of beer in a pub, just like after he's been on Mars for however long. It's a very British way to end the book. So it kind of ends abruptly, and then he has this whole postscript kind of pulling things out. There's a whole letter from Ransom that he's writing to someone kind of explaining his experiences. And so that's another reason I kind of think that Lewis was treating that book in itself as kind of a standalone there and back again sort of story, that it's like this happened, it was, and then we're back, basically.
Okay, so first book, Ransom goes to Mars, comes back. Second book, Paralandra. So tell the plot roughly of that book, because it's pretty amazing.
So yes, Paralandra, I would have to say, honestly, I hate being asked which one's my favorite, but when forced, I have to say Paralandra, because I love that book. It is funny though, because the plot is very simple, actually. It's a very simple plot, and there's a lot of conversation and talking and Lewis doing what he does, which is unraveling really deep and difficult theological and philosophical issues in conversations between his characters in a way that just puts it in a light that you never had considered it before. So the plot, very simply, is that Lewis, because of his adventures in the first book, because primarily of his ability to speak the language.
You mean Ransom?
Did I say Lewis?
I get them
Lewis,
confused also, because you know, you feel like Ransom's a lot like Lewis, but yeah.
Thank you. Ransom. And then Lewis shows up, though, too. That's the other thing, is Lewis as a character shows up in the book. Actually, at the beginning of Paralandra, he goes to visit Ransom, the character. So then you have Lewis, the author, Lewis, the character, and Ransom, who is basically Lewis, the author. So it gets very complicated. But Ransom is sent on a mission to Paralandra, primarily, again, mainly just because he can speak the language.
Right.
So he knows the language. He can speak to the people who live there on Paralandra. And so they send him there because there's going to be a danger that he needs to warn them about.
When you say they send him there, the Oyarsa, these are angelic beings. So these are good guys.
Yes.
The Oyarsa and the Eldilla, is that what they're called? The higher level?
Yes.
So yeah, these are these angelic beings. And there's clear correspondence, you know, that Lewis is not inventing. Like, these are basically angels, but he calls them Oyarsa. So you're saying they send Ransom to Venus because he can speak old solar. Did they know what his mission is? Does he stumble on the mission? I mean, he doesn't know what his mission is.
Yeah, so he doesn't know what it is. And he makes a comment, because in the beginning he's talking to Lewis, the character. So Lewis inserts himself into the story as a character who goes to visit Ransom. And Ransom is explaining to that character what his mission is. And he even says, I don't really know what it's going to be. They haven't told me. I don't know. And he even says something like, there are some missions for which it's better one knows less. Basically, the less one knows about one's mission, the better. So in that sense, I talk about this in my book, is that I feel like Ransom has more of a prophetic role in this book. See, he's being sent on a mission. He doesn't always know what exactly he's going to do. So he's trusting that he will be given the right words to say, that he'll be given the insight to know what it is he is to do at the appropriate time, which is very much a prophetic sort of role that he has. So he goes to Venus, and then he ends up meeting the Green Lady on Venus, who, she's not human, but she's very humanoid in her
well,
being.
She's like,
she's
the
just,
Eve.
She's green.
I mean, it's like there's an
like
Adam
the
and Eve
of
characters
yes.
of Venus. But Lewis calls her the Green Lady, and then she's the what? She's the queen of that world, mm-hmm. and the king of that world, the Adam of that world, is her husband or whatever. So this character Ransom meets this Green Lady.
Yes, and basically from that point on, I mean, they have a lot of conversations. So there's a lot of talking for a while, just trying to feel one another out, understand each other. And then Weston, who was one of the baddies from the first book, comes back to Paralandra. But we find out later that he has been possessed by either a devil or the devil. It's somewhat ambiguous. And he's been possessed. So he's basically not Weston anymore. So Ransom starts calling him the Unman in his mind.
Look, that is so creepy.
Is crazy.
It is one of the most... The Unman, this character, is one of the creepiest characters in the history of literature. And Lewis is such a genius for being able to create this character who is effectively possessed. So he's like a talking corpse. It's like a nightmare. And it's so brilliant. So he is sent, Weston, who is evil to begin with, but now he's given himself over to evil. So he is a complete, like a carrier of evil. He is this truly evil, and Lewis calls him the Unman, which is just creepy. It's like he's a man who's not a man. He's like a dead man talking.
Exactly. And yeah, so I think I agree with you. He's one of the creepiest characters, and Lewis does an excellent job writing that in that way. And then, so he is trying to, basically, he's acting like the Satan of that unfallen. If we see Paralandra kind of as Garden of Eden, and the Green Lady is the Eve of that world, the Unman is coming in as the Satan of that world, trying to tempt her to disobey the one command that has been given, which is to, so there's all these floating islands, and then there's the fixed land, which is the land that doesn't float, doesn't move. And the command has been given that they are not to spend the night on the fixed land. So they can visit it, but they can't spend the night there. That's the one command. And his whole purpose is to try to get her to disobey that command, so to cause the fall of that world.
So it's like a retelling of Paradise Lost. It's a retelling of the first few chapters of Genesis in another world. I mean, it's so amazingly done. It's brilliant, but it's brilliantly done. And that's Paralandra, the second book. And it's basically a retelling of the story of the fall, except in this story, the Satan figure does not succeed in tempting the Eve of that world. And the whole book is about this. I mean, it's you talk about epic. It's an epic poem. It's like Paradise Lost, except it's kind of weird because Milton, you know, retold the story that he got. Lewis invents a story in a whole other world and then has to figure out, so what would that look like if the Satan figure doesn't succeed? What would that battle look like? And I mean, it's just, it's so rich, and it's just theologically rich. It's philosophically rich. And it's also an exciting story. That's pretty tough to pull off, but he seems to have pulled it off.
Somehow he does. Yes.
I mean, I think some people think it's his greatest book. It's certainly, if not his great, I think it's probably his greatest book, but, So say more about this. You just mentioned floating islands. I mean, that alone, Lewis creates a world that you keep bumping into things. You think, how did he think of this? What a brilliant idea, floating island. There are all these floating islands. And so you said that the number one thing, the only thing that God basically forbids this Adam and Eve from doing is spending the night on the fixed land. So, like, that's the one command, and then you have this unmanned figure trying to really seduce this woman into the sin of disobeying that, and that's where Ransom kind of comes in to do battle with this Satan figure.
Yes, and it's really fascinating to me the more I read that book, to the methods that the unmanned, the Satan figure, uses to try to sway the Green Lady to listening to him, right? To disobey. Because if you've read Paradise Lost, and have that comparison kind of in your head, it's very interesting to see how Lewis presents it in a different way. So vanity comes into play in both of them. So in Milton's Paradise Lost, there's this sort of, the devil in that story is kind of playing to Eve's vanity. There it's a little bit more almost physical vanity, right? Showing her how beautiful she is. And Milton kind of plays that up. The unman in Paralandra tries to do that. Actually, he like dresses her up and shows her reflection, but it doesn't really move her very much. He's playing on her emotional vanity. So trying to get her to see how sacrifice she could basically is making a sacrifice for the good of her children, and kind of this playing up, she will be this noble kind of matriarch, right, be looked up to, and it's for your future children, basically trying to play up her the vanity in herself, not externally but internally. And so that's a fascinating comparison, the more that you dig into Milton and Lewis. And Lewis even wrote about Milton frequently. He wrote a wonderful little essay called Preface to Paradise Lost. Lost, longer than an essay. It's a few chapters long. It's just excellent and really unpacks a lot of what he thought about Milton. And
when
that comes into play in this
Do you
this
remember
book.
When he wrote Preface to Paradise Lost? Because I remember reading that, and boy, that's brilliant. But that gives you some insight into his thinking on all this stuff. But I don't remember.
I don't remember exact year. If I had to say, I would say it was before the Ransom trilogy was written.
Right.
That would be my guess. But I don't know an exact year.
Yeah, I was going to say, did it help him begin thinking about these things? But we don't know. On the break, maybe we'll look that up, because it is so clear when you read Paralandra that it's an analog to Paradise Lost, and that I keep saying that. If we lived in a sane world, it would be taught, Paradise Lost and Paralandra would be taught together, like in a survey course of Western lit, because they correspond to each other so dramatically. At least that's my theory.
Yes, yes, they do. As well as Purgatorio from Dante. Dante's Divine Comedy, too.
Oh, my God.
Purgatorio.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's now, do you teach Dante also?
I don't currently, because I teach literature to junior high students, so they're a little, Purgatory is a little bit maybe beyond them at the moment.
Yeah.
But
Wow.
But it was one of the Divine Comedy was one of Lewis's favorite, if not his favorite. He doesn't always call favorites, but he has the highest praise for Dante's Divine Comedy. It was a really key part of his conversion, in fact, as well. And so he references Dante all over the place across the trilogy.
Now, I'm a little surprised I don't remember that. Can you refresh my memory? Because I don't remember that he was that it figured somehow in his conversion. Can you remember any details?
Yes. So prior to his conversion, he read the entire thing in Italian, in the original Italian, of course, yeah, with a friend. And he wrote some letters about it back and forth with this friend, basically saying that it reaches heights of poetry that poetry has never reached before and probably never will again. It just gave him, this kind of transcendent experience. And he talks about in Surprised by Joy about reading Phantasties by George MacDonald and how that gave him this concept of the holy. And he says something similar in a letter about Dante's Divine Comedy as well, specifically Paradiso, which is the third part of Dante's Divine Comedy. He uses kind of similar language when talking about that it introduced something to him that basically made him long for something that he didn't really have words for, which he comes to find out is Christ, is the gospel in his conversion. He read it significantly enough before his conversion, but it you can see when he talks about it that it's pushing him that direction.
That's amazing. That's just not something that I remember having heard before, and I feel pretty familiar with Lewis's. So I'm surprised to hear that, but it makes perfect sense. If you can, in 2 minutes, I dare you to sum up the plot of the third book. We'll talk about that as we continue the conversation. But just since we have a couple of minutes left, how in the world do you describe the final book in the trilogy titled That Hideous Strength?
That stumps people, right? The first two, you can kind of see, okay, they're interplanetary, traveling to other planets, maybe a little more sci-fi effect here and there. But that third book, it stays on Earth. There's no planetary travel, at least by men, that they don't travel in a spaceship or anything in the third book. And it's a very fascinating book because the main characters, at least Ransom himself and the characters he surrounds himself with, don't actually make the final stand, right? We have other characters that kind of do that for them. So it really is the culmination of the first two books. I would describe it as a collision of worldviews. It's a collision of philosophies that have come to fruition. The collision of the materialist, reductionist worldview that drives this pseudoscience. I mean, it starts out science, but ends in basically demon worship, right, and possession in the end, versus the, I would say, incarnationalist Christians, you could say, right? So you have this conflict that comes to a head where you have the society on the one hand, the NICE, that is trying to push their agenda, and it's a very evil, demonic agenda. And then you have the group surrounding Ransom, who's taking a stand against that. So it's this, and what's funny, though, is that you have this back and forth, right, between these two characters, which is different from the other books. So even though I would still argue that the Ransom trilogy is a good name for it, this third book does take the spotlight off of Ransom and focuses on the married couple, Jane and Mark Studdick, and their relationship with each other. And then when they're apart, it kind of flips back and forth, right? We go from focusing on Mark to then next chapter, we might be over here with Jane and what she's doing. And which is very different structure from the first two books.
Yeah.
Which
I mean, it really is. Well, it's such a bizarrely different book. And it's such a bizarre book. There's just no way around it. I don't know. I mean, can you compare it to anything? I almost don't know that I can compare it to anything.
I haven't found anything quite like it. No,
right?
It's because you still have that thread of planet interplanetary, the medieval cosmology. But Between Paralandra and That He Is Strength, Lewis became really good friends with Charles Williams, who was known for his Arthurian scholarship. So he was Arthurian myth and legend was his one of his specialties. So Lewis just became captivated and enraptured with that. And his was the personality where anything that he was kind of really into worked its way into everything, right? He was very much a whole person, right? It's like he couldn't just be like, oh, and that's my hobby off to the side. It's like that came out in his writing. So the whole idea with Merlin and
Merlin,
Arthur
the figure
up,
of Merlin is resurrected in the book
yes.
That Hideous Strength. It really is. That Hideous Strength seems like a prophetic book for today. I've never seen anything like
Definitely.
It. It is creepy. You want to talk about like deep state, demonic, whatever you want to. It's just really creepy, powerful, kind of funny that Lewis's Ransom trilogy is so, you know, big and amazing that it almost you need a guide, somebody to help you hold your hand, to be a Virgil, recall the Divine Comedy, to sort of be your guide somehow through this. And that's what you are in this book. Do you think of yourself as a Virgil?
Well, I hope so. I try to. Right. That's the goal. The goal is to give someone a foundation, at least. There's definitely so much more. As I've had more and more conversations about this book and questions that I've had about it, I realize, you know, there has to be maybe a third and fourth and fifth edition or something. It'll keep getting bigger because there's always more. There's always more. And so sometimes, you know, as a writer, after it's gone off to the printers, you can be like, oh, I wish I had included that. But really, in essence, the point is to give people a launching pad. It's like here is a foundation, here's a start, here's glimpses of the depths and the richness that is to be found in this series, and to hopefully give you handles to grab onto so that then, hopefully, down the road in 5, 10, 20 years, there will be even more books like this that go even deeper or that spot things that I haven't seen because people have gone that direction, right? Because they see a start to it here.
Well, reading C.S. Lewis for me over the years, it really is a genuine education in understanding life and the world. I mean, I understand the Bible dramatically better because I have read C.S. Lewis. That's what I find so amazing about C.S. Lewis, is that the Narnia Chronicles have given me an understanding of theological issues that I don't know that I would have understood them any other way if I hadn't read the Narnia Chronicles. And I feel the same way about these three books, the so-called Ransom Trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, Paralandra, and the last one, That Hideous Strength, that they help you see things and understand things. I mean, for example, you were just talking about how in the last book, That Hideous Strength, it's a clash between these two worldviews, one of which is beautiful and of God, and the other one is demonic. It's this creepy, reductionist, scientific, it's like evil science. It's just so creepy. But it reminds me that, I don't know, are you familiar with the book Chancer the Dance by Thomas Howard?
I have read it, yes.
Okay.
It's been a while, but I am familiar.
Well, that book, I mean, that's an example of a book that Thomas Howard met C.S. Lewis, and I guess it was 1961, and really writes in that tradition. And his book, Chancer the Dance, could be like a C.S. Lewis book. It's so – but he directly addresses this issue that you brought up of their two worldviews. One is kind of the medieval Christian worldview – and then the other one is this reductionist, atheistic, materialistic worldview that's impossibly bleak. And reading Thomas Howard helped me really to understand this so that when I read Lewis, I kind of get it. But I think that as people read all of these books, it really shapes your imagination. It helps you to think more clearly and helps you understand the world more clearly. So these are not just, you know, fun books to read, which obviously you deal with this in your book, this the deeper issue of comprehending the universe as you read these books.
Yeah, and understanding it as a story rather than a set of data points, which is why I think the Chronicles of Narnia and the Ransom Trilogy are so important and effective, is that there's things that you can communicate in a in an academic essay, maybe as data points or in a more didactic sort of manner, that won't hit the same as a good story does. That you can present these truths in a fictional, in a world, in a story, and you don't have to hit it really hard. It's just there, and it kind of, it slips past our defenses, really, and it can affect us emotionally in a way that a list of data points doesn't, which I think is one reason why the Chronicles of Narnia are so amazing as stories for kids, because you have these very simple children's books that just kids love, but there's so much depth there that slips past a lot of the guards that might be up if you were trying to make an argument, right? Or have a logical syllogism laid out there. And that's why I think that's why Jesus uses parables when he's communicating, is that we're made for story, right? God's telling a story. He's writing the universe, writing our story. And so we are oriented towards stories. And so what Lewis brilliantly does in these books, these fiction books, is communicate really, really heavy issues, and I use that word on purpose, is they're weighty, and somehow he communicates them in a way that just sticks and resonates, and people are willing to read them where they might not go read a treatise on, you know, materialistic reductionism over here.
But I tell you,
they'll read it in a book.
It's interesting, because I've often said that, you know, I've written three biographies, and in the course of writing them, I've realized that when you tell the story of a life, it's very different than making a bunch of points, like you just said. Now, there's one, there's something holistic and human about it. It's a story. And the other one is kind of reductionist and sort of inhuman and bleak and kind of enlightenment rationality versus this holistic idea of a story and of life. Because God is a person. He is not an energy force or a list of rules or whatever. And so in a way, Lewis communicates that, but he also lives that out in the way that in writing these stories. It's kind of fascinating in a way. You can never escape these ideas, that the idea of a story, that's God. The Bible is this story. It's not a list of rules. And if you read it as a list of rules, you're going to miss the point. You have to get the story and the redemption and all that stuff. And so Lewis profoundly gets that. I mean, that's what's so beautiful about him. He can communicate things that they're impossible to communicate any other way. I want to talk to you just more about your book because there's so much in it, really, and that there's so much in Lewis, and you get out so much of it. But that, to go back to the medieval cosmology, you mentioned that earlier, right? Like, you talk about, and again, Michael Ward, I've interviewed Michael Ward for Socrates in the City. If anybody, I highly recommend people go to socratesinthecity.com and watch my conversation with Michael Ward, because it touches on a lot of this stuff and helps it come to life. But Michael Ward talks about this idea that you're talking about, that the medieval cosmos, they would say, like, Mars has a personality. It's like it has that's where we get the word martial, war. Venus is about love. And so there's this in the Narnia Chronicles, you see this in each of the books. But you write about that with regard to the Ransom trilogy. And how, I can't remember, how real is that in the Ransom trilogy, this K factor, when you're reading about Perelandra versus reading about Mars? Is it there yet, or does he develop this more in the Narnia books?
I think it does come out. It's a little less hidden because it is, you know, the first book is set on Mars. So it makes sense for there to be a martial atmosphere in all the details, right? And so it does come out. Same thing with Perelandra, is set on Venus. And so he uses that, the personality, the medieval personality of Venus, in all of his descriptions, down to the fact that the sky is the color of copper, copper is related to Venus. That's her metal. If you read in the medieval, there's a metal associated with each of the planets, and copper is Venus's metal. So just the color choices, there's a lot of green and copper, green for growing things, which again is related to Venus. So he uses the medieval cosmology and the personality of the planets in his setting, in the atmosphere and description of both Mars and Venus in the first two books. In the third book, you might expect, well, it's on Earth, so it's a little more obscure. And I would say it is, though there is that one chapter where the Oryarsa of each planet actually comes down to Earth, and he describes the effect of each one as they arrive. And that's basically, if you want to, aside from his nonfiction works like The Discarded Image, which is his work on medieval literature, if you want just kind of a short summary to get an idea of what is this personality of the planets, just read that chapter in That He Has Strength. Like, that chapter with those paragraphs on each planet kind of gives you a very condensed idea of what Lewis thought of the personality of each planet. So In That Hideous Strength.
I don't remember that.
Chapter,
it's been so many years since I've read these books. So in That Hideous Strength, there's a chapter on this.
Yes, it's called The Descent of the Gods, I believe, is the chapter where each one comes down to Earth because they're basically imbuing Merlin with special power to go take out the bad guys.
I need to reread these books. What is your sense? Because you've written, of course, Christiana, a whole book about this. You've devoted years to this now. But what is your sense as you talk to people or as people interview about this book of what people know about these books? Or for many people, is this something that they've just never heard of?
So I find a mix. Generally, the people I talk to have heard of them, at least, have heard of them. And so many, though, have the response is, I tried to read them once, and they didn't make it very far. But it's funny because I do find a mixed bag. Some people love Out of the Silent Planet. They zipped through it and they loved it. And then Paralandra is what got them. They couldn't make it through Paralandra. Or they really don't care for the first two, but they love That Hideous Strength. And actually, a surprising number of people that read That Hideous Strength on its own as a standalone book. Which I kind of understand why. I mean, we've already mentioned how it's very prophetic in a lot of ways. It's very pertinent. It's as applicable today as it was when it was written, if not more so. And I think people hear that about it and then go read it, and they pick it up and they just read that book rather than reading the trilogy as a whole. But among those people, Merlin catches people up a lot. So I feel like I'm hearing more and more people that at least have heard of the books, but not as many that have read the whole trilogy or love the whole trilogy equally. So that's part of the reason for my book, reasoning behind it, is to present it as, I do think that this trilogy is a whole. I think the books are each very different, but that they hang together and work together as a whole trilogy, and that they're important to be read in that way as an entire trajectory. There's a trajectory to the three books that makes a lot of sense and actually reveals even more of what Lewis was trying to do.
When I think of That Hideous Strength, the third of these books and the longest, right? It feels to me like a fictional way for Lewis of dealing with the ideas in the abolition of man.
Yes. Yeah. And he actually says that in the preface, I believe. He says...
I don't remember that. Yeah, I'm glad I got that right.
He does. Okay. Yeah. He says, this is basically a fictional treatment of the ideas that I expressed in my essay, Abolition of Man. So if you want to go read that, you should.
Oh, that's hilarious. I mean, it's been many years since I've read any of those books, but it makes sense. And so, I mean, maybe sum up, if you can, the concept of the abolition of man, because that's a short book, and it's a very important book. My goodness, it's very short, very important. Do you remember when Lewis wrote The Abolition of Man? Because I don't.
So I have my book right here, and it has an appendix in it with the dates of Lewis's.
Oh, that's very helpful.
So I realized that I had that here, and I should have looked at it before. So he published The Abolition of Man in 1943, and That Heat of Strength came out in 45. So a couple years later.
Oh, well, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? That's absolutely that makes perfect sense. Okay, so what are the ideas in The Abolition of Man? Because this is really central.
Yes, and one of the really key factors that Lewis talks about is actually in Abolition of Man is actually a medieval concept, which is the medieval concept of a man, a whole man being made up of three parts: the head, the chest, and the stomach, and that those three elements represent reason, passion or appetite, and the third element, which is the chest, which is kind of the seat of stable emotion or stable sentiment, and it's that element that kind of balances the other two. So what Lewis, and this is important to Lewis's primary issue with the reigning worldview and that he saw coming out, especially in education, which is that we're not actually educating the entire man in our education. We're trying to, in his time, focus on either just pure rationality, right? Pure reason, logic, alone, science, you could say, or we're giving way to animal appetite and with no reigning emotion over that, right? And so the chest, the seat of the emotions, is what balances out those other two and actually creates a whole and entire person. And that our education should be aimed at creating whole and entire people rather than just almost mechanical robots that just have a set of data points programmed into their brains. And so that is actually the kind of the key element that comes out in That Heat of Strength. With the NICE, which is the organization that Ransom and his group is fighting against, is that they're basically trying to strip humanity of everything that really makes it human and just reduce it down to atoms and just the pure physical side of things.
And it's it corresponds to where we are today so dramatically. It's just amazing to me, even the idea that this place is called NICE, nice, like, you know, be nice. But, you know, being nice is not the same as being good. And now the chapter, I think, in Abolition of Man that we're referring to is called Men Without Chests. But boy, oh boy, folks, yes. Grab it, read it. It's so fascinating to me that Lewis was very much a prophet, you know, not in the mystical sense, although James Como argues that in some ways he had to be a prophet in the mystical sense because he wrote about things that were, anyway, they were not just of the head. But that chapter we just referenced, the Men Without Chests, I mean, that sort of sums up everything about what's wrong with where we are today. And I think it can help a lot of people understand what's wrong, because I think a lot of people don't know how to process what's happening in the world today. And I think Lewis just magnificently does that. So talk a little bit more about that idea of men without chests, because it's really at the heart, no pun intended, of everything that we're dealing with.
Yes. And so obviously we have the two extremes, right? There's the two extremes. If you don't have the chest or the middle element, which is that balancing, you can almost say balancing or reigning element, you're either going to give way to just pure logic and reason, which is going to basically cut you off from any emotion, whether it's stable or otherwise, right? You have that cold logic, scientific side. And then on the other side, you have the other ditch, which is being enslaved to your desires, right? Your appetite. And so then you have no reigning philosophy whatsoever. It's just whatever feels good, whatever you want, which we can see a lot going on today. And Lewis talks about this in a little bit in the sense when he's mentioning using the word sublime, and that there is, when you call something sublime, there's this educational tendency that he saw cropping up in his day to say, well, you're not actually making any statement about the reality in front of you. You're purely making a statement about your own feelings about that reality, when you say that waterfall is sublime, you're just saying that it gives you sublime feelings. There's not actually a correspondence between the language that you're using to describe it and the reality, which in essence breaks down any meaning whatsoever. There is no meaning, and all your language is just a reflection of what's going on
okay,
in your head.
Now, the key to this, to me, today, is that when people say, I feel like I'm a woman, even though biologically you would see me as a man, I say, I feel I'm a woman. The subjectivity of things and the rejection of reality, that's really what Lewis is writing about. A long,
yes.
long time ago, he put his finger on this issue mm-hmm. that the, that subjectivity, it's a way of making the self God and saying that God's reality, I reject God's reality. I can be what I want to be. I reject it. I hate it. I curse it. It's really creepy because there's something spiritual.
Yeah.
And we see
yeah.
that going on dramatically today where we're being told by people with no argument that you must accept what I say about myself or whatever. And you think, well, wait a minute, there's this thing called reality. And they're like, no, there's no such thing called reality. And mm-hmm. we say, no, there's God and God created reality and it's not really mutable. It's reality. And that's the battle we're fighting right now. And Lewis is writing about this in The Abolition of Man, literally 80 years ago.
And we've taken it, I feel like it's gone even a step farther in some ways. You know, in his time, it was we can't actually make a statement about reality. What the statements we make are just really reflections of our feelings on reality. But where we've gone to even more, and I think he saw this coming, is that we can actually impose those feelings onto reality and make it what we want it, which we see that a little bit in that Hideous Strength, that they are the NICE is trying to basically imprint its version of reality onto the physical material world. So we go from, well, you can't really make any statements about what is real or what is not. Everything you say is just a reflection of your own psyche, your own feelings, to now those feelings that you have can actually be manifested and you can make them a reality and everyone around you has to recognize that reality. So they can have their own reality as long as it doesn't encroach upon your reality. So I think Lewis saw that coming because it's just the natural next step of dissociating yourself basically from the world around you and saying there is no objective truth and the world outside me is basically a blank canvas. The material world is a blank canvas. It's clay that I can shape into whatever mold I want. And that just leads us down a crazy rabbit hole, really.
Well, I mean, I guess Lewis did see it in his time because another way of describing this is called it's the triumph of the will, the triumph of the self over God's reality, which is a satanic project. And he obviously saw this happening in intellectual circles. And then you see it happening, obviously, in Germany, where you try to create. I mean, it's always, it's tragicomic because you know it can never succeed. Reality is reality. God is he's created this stubborn thing called reality, and you can kick against the goads sometimes for decades, but in the end, reality always wins. You know, the truth will out. But what Lewis is talking about is this satanic desire to undo God's reality and to create our own reality. So it really is like Satan in Milton's Paradise Lost. It's I want to reign in my reality and I want to undo God's reality. And so there's just so much here. It's so rich, and it's all through so much of what Lewis writes.
Yes. And it's the better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven that Satan says in Paradise Lost, or questioning, and from the beginning, it's the essential lie, has God indeed said, right? Questioning what God has said, and then what is your objective duty then to that commandment? And I think the thing is, it is very consistent with an evolutionary materialistic worldview, right? If matter is all there is, and we came from goo, and we've been changing and shaping and becoming different things for billions of years, then why can't I just keep doing that, right? So it is consistent, self-consistent, but very much obviously against what we know to be true.
Christiana Hale, what are you doing when you're not talking about this this new book? I mean, you teach junior high, really?
I do. Yes, Latin and English. So easy subjects, but
yeah.
No, it is a fun age. It's challenging. Every time I say I teach junior high, you know, people react different ways, but it is a challenging age, but I love teaching that age. It's a really formulative period, I think, in our maturation, and they're just excited and interested in everything. So it keeps me on my toes, answering lots of random questions. You know, never quite know what a 13-year-old is going to ask you today.
Right.
So,
right.
But yeah, I love it, and it really is. I mean, it's an extension of what I love in other areas. So I love research and writing, and so teaching kids all day. It just basically is a captive audience. They literally cannot leave that I get to just talk to all day about the things I like.
It's just amazing. You know. Now, are you working? Do you do other writing? I think you do, right? You've written other books, or you're working on other books. What else is happening in your life in terms of writing?
Yeah, I am working on other books. So I just finished my master's of fine arts in creative writing. So it's funny. It is funny to me. If you had told me back when I was a teenager that my first book was going to be a nonfiction guide to C.S. Lewis, I probably would have laughed at you, because as many high schoolers, I loved writing novels. I wrote fiction. I always wanted to be a writer, but I was primarily interested in telling stories and writing fiction. And so it still makes me laugh sometimes that this is the trajectory that my life has taken, but I have not abandoned writing fiction. So I am working on a novel currently. It's still in process of being drafted, various drafts. So we'll see what happens. And I'm still studying Lewis, still working on research there. There's potentially another Lewis book coming out in the future. It's the road, but I'm
on what aspect
Till We Have Faces.
Oh my goodness.
Till We Have Faces.
There's another heavy one, man. Wow.
Another heavy one. So that would probably be a little ways down the road, because I'm in research mode right now, which takes, you know, that's the bulk of my writing process is the research mode, and then got to get going on writing. So it's going to be a down the road a ways, but that's the other one that gets people scratching their heads, I feel. It's another one that people either love it or hate it and or confused by it and have questions. So, and it's another one that I absolutely love and think is one of his best fictional works.
There's no doubt that Paralandra and Till We Have Faces are literary masterpieces. There's no question about it. Okay, just seconds left. What's the roughly the setting of this fiction, this work of fiction that you're working on?
Thank you. So it's a fantastical realism, I would say. So it's set in the current time, set in the Pacific Northwest, because that's what I know. And there's a witch and there's dragons and lots of adventure. So it's pretty fun.
Unbelievable. And it's set in the present. Crazy.
Yes, it is.
Crazy. Well, look, it's just a delight to get to know you and your work. The book Deeper Heaven is just a wonderful achievement. And it is genuinely important, and I know that many people will be introduced to Lewis's Ransom trilogy as a result of your having written this book, Deeper Heaven. So, Christiana Hale, thank you for that, and thank you for your time. God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn. deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.